says Charmaine indignantly. Today, this time, you may encounter a situation that you find challenging. Despite this, the procedure must be carried out. Your future here depends on it. Are you ready for that?
What kind of situation? Charmaine asks.
You have an option, says the head. You can resign from medications administration right now and go back to towel folding or some other undemanding form of work if you feel you are not up to the test.
It smiles,
showing its strong square teeth.
Charmaine would like to ask if she could have some time to think it over. But maybe that wouldn't be taken well. The head could see it as a flaw in her loyalty.
You must decide now, says the head. Are you ready?
Yes, says Charmaine. I'm ready.
All right, then, says the head. You have now chosen. There are only two kinds of people admitted to the medications administration wing. Those who do and those who are done to. You have elected the role of those who do. If you fail, the consequences to yourself will be severe. You may find yourself playing the other role. Do you understand?
Yes, says Charmaine faintly. That was a threat. If she doesn't eliminate, she'll be eliminated. It's very clear. Her hands are cold.
Very well, says the head. Here are the details of your procedure for today.
The slip of paper slides out of the slot. Charmaine picks it up. The room number and the sedative information are there, but the name is missing.
There isn't any name,
Charmaine says. But the head has vanished.
Choice. Stan lets his mind float free. Time is passing. Whatever will happen to him is about to happen. There's not a thing he can do about it. Are these my last minutes? He asks himself. Surely not. Despite his earlier moment of panic, he's now oddly calm. But not resigned. Not numbed. Instead, he's intensely, painfully alive. He can feel his own thunderous heartbeat. He can hear the blood surging through his veins. He can sense every muscle, every tendon. His body is massive, like rock, like granite, though possibly a little soft around the middle. I should have worked out more, he thinks. I should have done everything more. I should have cut loose from what? Looking back on his life, he sees himself spread out on the earth like a giant covered in tiny threads that have held him down. Tiny threads of petty cares and small concerns and fears he took seriously at the time. Debts, timetables, the need for money, the longing for comfort, the earworm of sex repeating itself over and over like a neural feedback loop. He's been the puppet of his own constricted desires. He shouldn't have let himself be caged in here, walled off from freedom. But what does freedom mean anymore? And who had caged him and walled him off? He'd done it himself. So many small choices. The reduction of himself to a series of numbers, stored by others, controlled by others. He should have left the disintegrating cities. Fled the pinched, cramped life on offer there. Broken out of the electronic net, thrown away all the passwords, gone forth to range over the land. A gaunt wolf howling at midnight. But there isn't any land to range over anymore. There isn't any place without fences, roadways, networks. Or is there? And who would go with him? Be with him? Supposing he can't find Connor. Supposing, unthinkable, that Connor is dead. Would Charmaine be up to such a trip? Would she even want him to smuggle her out? Would she consider it rescue? She's never liked camping. She wouldn't want to do without her clean, flowered sheets. Still, he has a brief flash of longing. The two of them, hand in hand, walking into the sunrise, all betrayals forgotten, ready for a new life, somewhere, somehow. With maybe some strike-anywhere matches and... what else would they need? He tries to visualize the world outside the wall of consilience. But he has no real picture of that world anymore. All he sees is fog.
Charmaine keys herself into the dispensary, locates the cabinet, codes open the door. She finds the vial and the needle. She pockets them, snaps on her latex gloves, then walks along the corridor to the left. These corridors are always empty when she's on her way to a procedure. Do they do that on purpose, so nobody will know who has terminated which person? Nobody, that is, except the head. And whoever is behind the head. And whoever may be watching her right now, from inside a light fixture, or through a tiny lens the size of a rivet. She straightens her shoulders, adjusts her face into what she hopes is a positive but determined expression. Here's the room. She opens the door, steps quietly in, removes her face mask. The man is lying on his back, attached to the gurney at 5 points, as he should be. His head is turned a little away from her. Most likely he's staring at the ceiling, whatever part of it he can see, and most likely the ceiling is staring back at him. "Hello," she says as she walks over to the gurney. "Isn't it a lovely day? Look at all the lovely sunshine. I always find a sunny day is really cheering. Don't you?" The man's head turns toward her, as far as it can turn. The eyes meet hers. It's Stan.
"Oh my gosh,"
says Charmaine. She almost drops the needle. She blinks, hoping the face will change into the face of someone else, a total stranger. But it doesn't change.
"Stan,"
she whispers,
"what are they doing to you? Oh, honey, what did you do?
Has he committed a crime? What kind of a crime? It must have been very bad. But maybe there was no crime, or just a little one, because what sort of a crime would Stan have done? He's sometimes grumpy, and he can lose his temper, but he's not mean as such. He's not the criminal type."
"Did you try to find me?" she says.
"Honey, you must have been crazy with worry. Did you..." Has his love for her driven him over the edge? Has he found out about Max and killed him? That would be terrible. A fatal threesome, like something she'd see on the TV news back at dusk. The sleazier news. Says Stan. There's a trickle of drool coming out of the corner of his mouth. Tenderly, she wipes it away. He's killed for her. He must have. His eyes are wide. He's pleading with her silently. This is more horrible than anything. She wants to rush out of the room, run back to her cell and shut the door and throw herself onto the bed and pull the covers over her head, and pretend that none of this has ever happened. But her feet don't move. All the blood is draining out of her brain. "Think, Charmaine," she tells herself. But she can't think. "Nothing bad is going to happen to you," she says as she usually does, but it's as if her mouth is moving by itself with a dead voice coming out, though the voice is trembling. Stan doesn't believe her. He says. He's straining against the bands that hold him in place.
"You're going to have such a great time," she says to him. "We'll have this done in a jiffy."
There are tears running out of her eyes. She blots them away with her sleeve, because such tears won't do, and she hopes no one has seen them. Not even Stan. Especially not Stan. "You'll be home really soon," she tells him. "And then we'll have a lovely dinner and watch TV." She moves behind him out of his line of vision.
and then we'll go to bed together the way we used to. Won't that be nice? The tears are coming harder. She can't help herself. She's flashing on the two of them when they were first married and planning. Oh, so many things for their new life together. A house and kids and everything. They were so sweet then. So hopeful. So young. Not like the way she is now. And then it hadn't worked out because of circumstances. And it was a strain. So many tensions. What with the car and everything. But they'd stayed together because they had each other and they loved each other. And then they'd come here and at first it was so lovely. So clean. Everything in its place with happy music and popcorn in front of the TV. But then there was that lipstick. The kiss she'd made with it. Starved. Her fault. Get hold of yourself, Charmaine, she tells herself. Don't be sentimental. Remember, it's a test. They're watching her. They can't be serious about this. They can't expect her to... Not kill, no. She will not use the kill word. They can't expect her to relocate her own husband. She strokes Stan's head. Shh, she says to him. It's okay. She always strokes their heads, but this time, it's not any old head. It's Stan's head, with his bristly haircut. She knows every feature of his head so well. Each eye, each ear, and the corner of his jaw, and the mouth with Stan's teeth in it, and the neck, and the body that's attached to it. It's almost glowing, that body. It's as clear to her as anything. Each freckle and hair, as if she's looking at it through a magnifying glass. She wants to throw her arms around that body to hold it still. Keep it in this present moment, because unless she can stop time, this body doesn't have a future. She can't do the procedure. She won't do it. She'll march out of here, back to reception, and demand to talk with the woman's head in the box. I'm not falling for this, she'll say. I'm not doing your stupid test, so just take a flying leap. But wait, what will happen then? Someone else will come in and relocate Stan. The bad thing will happen to him anyway. And whoever it is will not do it in a considerate and respectful way. Not the way she does. And what will become of her, Charmaine, if she fails the test? It won't just be back to towel folding. It will be into the plastic cuffs and the hood and the shackles like Sandy. Then onto the gurney with the five straps. That must be why they put Sandy in her cell. As a warning. She's shivering now. She can hardly breathe. Oh, Stan, she whispers into his left ear. I don't know how things got this way. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. Says Stan. It's like a dog whimper. But he's heard her. He understands. Is that a nod? She kisses him on the forehead. Then, taking a big chance, she kisses him on the mouth. A heartfelt, lingering kiss. He doesn't kiss her back. His mouth must be paralyzed. But at least he doesn't try to bite her. Then she sticks the needle into the vial. She watches her hands in their latex gloves moving like seaweed. Her arms are heavy, as if she's swimming in liquid glue. Everything's in slow motion. Standing behind Stan, she feels gently for the vein in his neck. Finds it. His heart beats like percussion under her fingertips. She slides in the needle. Then a jolt. Then a spasm. Like electrocution. Then she hits the floor. Blackout.
Part 8. Erase Me. Bend. When Stan wakes up, he's no longer strapped down. He's curled up on his side, lying on something soft. He's dizzy, and he's got a crashing headache, like 3 prime hangovers all at once. He unglues his eyelids. Several pairs of big white eyes with round black pupils are staring into his. What the shit are these? He struggles to sit up, loses his balance, flounders in a mound of small, yielding, fuzzy bodies. Enormous spiders? Caterpillars? Despite himself, he yelps. A grip, Stan, he tells himself. Get 2, they're cheap. Ah. He's lying in a large bin filled with knitted blue teddy bears. Those are the white, round-pupiled eyes watching him. Fuck, he says. Then he adds for good measure, fucking hell. At least he's got his voice back. He's in a warehouse with metal rafters and a dim strip of fluorescent lighting overhead. Peering over the side of the bin, he scopes out the floor. Cement. That must be why they put him on top of the teddy bears. There's nothing else in this place that's in any way soft. Someone's been thoughtful. He feels around his own body. Parts all accounted for. Thank crap they got rid of the diaper or whatever that was. Though it's humiliating to visualize the removal process. They've even put some new clothes on him. An orange positron boiler suit plus a fleece jacket. And thick socks, because it's cold as a witch's tit in here. Stands to reason, it's February. And why heat a warehouse with nothing in it but teddy bears? What next? Where is everyone? Not a good idea to shout. Maybe get up, find the exit? But wait. One of his legs is tethered to the side of the metal bin with, yes, a nylon cuff. That must be to keep him from wandering around, leaving this warehouse, bumping into whoever's outside the door. Nothing to do but wait until Jocelyn comes and tells him what the fuck he's supposed to do. He checks over the warehouse interior once again. More bins like the one he's lying in, arranged in a row. That's a freaking large number of teddy bears. Also, over toward what he's now identified as the doors, a small one for people, a big sliding one for trucks, there are some stacks of long boxes that look a lot like coffins, narrower at one end. He sure hopes he's not shut up in here with a bunch of soon-to-be-rotting corpses. Which is what Charmaine must think he already is himself. A sad, deluded rabbit. Her distress wasn't faked. Those tears were real. She was shaking when she felt his neck and then stuck the needle into it. She must have truly believed she was murdering him. She must have passed out right after that. In the split second before the drug hit him and he went out in a blissful swirl of colored lights, he'd heard the impact as she did a vertical faceplant onto the floor. If he'd had money on the proposition that Charmaine would never go through with it, he'd have lost the bet. She's amazing in her own way, Charmaine. Under all that froth, she has guts. He has to give her that. He thought she'd let love get in the way, that she'd lose her nerve and start whimpering and back off, that she'd maybe throw herself onto him, wreck the plan. So much for his ability to second guess. Jocelyn's fix on Charmaine had been better than his. Poor Charmaine, he thinks. She must be putting herself through hell right now. Remorse, guilt, and so forth. How does he feel about that? Part of him, the vengeful part, is saying, serves her right, her and her cheating heart, and he hopes she writhes in anguish and boo-hoos her angelic blue eyes out. Another part is saying, to be fair, Stan, you've cheated on her too, both in intention and in deed. True, you thought you were chasing a different purple passion than the one you caught, with whom you had sex on many occasions, and though your heart may not have been into it, your body was, or into it enough. So let bygones be bygones and wipe the slate. Yeah, says the vengeful part. But dumb Charmaine doesn't know about Jocelyn, so if you ever get back together with her, you can hold her fling with Max slash Phil over her head forever. Tell her you've seen the videos. Repeat back to her the things she says on them. Turn her into a handful of soggy tissue. Wipe your boots on her. There would be some satisfaction in that. Not to mention the fact that she murdered you. She'll be your slave. She'll never dare say no to you. She'll wait on you hand and foot. Either that, or she'll put rodent poison in your coffee. There's a steely side to her. Don't discount it. So maybe you should strike first, given the chance. Dump her. Toss her clothes onto the lawn. Lock the door. Or hit her on the head with a brick. Is that what Connor would do? You forget, he tells himself. I'll probably never be back inside that house again. Unless something goes wrong once I'm outside the wall, I'll never be back in Consilience. That life is gone. I'm supposed to be dead. Should he be angry about that? Maybe not. Being dead is for his own good. On the other hand, he didn't ask to be dead. He didn't wish it upon himself. He's simply been assigned, as if he's a member of an army in which he's never enlisted. He's been fucking drafted against his will, and meanwhile, he's in here chained to a bin full of knitted bears. And that sadistic bitch Jocelyn seems to have forgotten all about him. And despite the headache, he's starting to feel hungry. Plus, he's freezing his nuts off. It's so cold that he can see his breath. He lies down again, covers himself with blue teddy bears. There'll be some insulation. The only thing to do right now is go to sleep.
Tea time. When Charmaine wakes up, she's alone. And she's back in her house. Their house, her as in Stan's. Or rather, her as in Stan's once. But now, only hers. Because Stan will never be in this house again. Never, 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 never. She starts to cry. She's lying on the sofa, the royal blue one with the pretty off-white lilies. Though with her face up close to it like this, she can see that it needs cleaning, because someone's been spilling coffee on it, and other things. She can remember pretending to dislike this pattern, pretending to want to change it, pretending she was going to look at fabric swatches as an excuse to leave the house early on switchover days so she could be with Max. Stan could be counted on to take no interest whatsoever in slip covers or wallpaper or any of those things. His lack of interest once annoyed her. Weren't they supposed to be home building together? But after that, she'd welcomed it, because it was a blind spot of his that gave her some time with Max. Now it makes her cry, because Stan is dead. There, she said it. Dead. She cries harder. She's sobbing, her breath coming in staccato gulps. Stan, what have I done to you? She thinks. Where have you gone? Though she's crying as hard as she can, she nevertheless notices a strange thing. She's no longer wearing her orange boiler suit. Instead, she has on a peach and gray checked outfit in a light wool weave, with a flared skirt and a fitted jacket. There's supposed to be a matching blouse, which is peach imitation silk, with peach flamenco dancer ruffles on the front. But that isn't the blouse she has on, which is a blue floral print and doesn't go with the outfit at all. She selected the peach and gray ensemble with care from the Smile and Style section of the digital catalog, just after she and Stan signed into Consilience. It was a choice between the peach and gray and the other combos, the navy blue and white, which was a little too Chanel for her, and the lime green and orange. No contest there, because she can't wear lime green. It washes her out. Plus, she folded up this outfit and stored it in her pink locker in the cellar, along with her other civilian clothes, right before going in for her latest stint at Positron. So someone has the code to her locker. And someone has been rummaging through her things. The very same somebody must have taken off the boiler suit and dressed her up in the checked outfit with the wrong blouse.
Feeling better now? Says a voice. She looks up from the sofa.
Holy heck. It's Aurora from Human Resources, with the overdone face job that makes her look like a gecko.
Unmoving cheek muscles pop eyes.
Aurora is about the last person she wants to see. Not only here and now, but ever.
She's carrying a tray.
Charmaine's tray, she picked it herself from the catalog's tray options. With a teapot on it. Charmaine's teapot, though it came with the house.
Charmaine feels invaded. How dare Aurora barge into her home while she herself is passed out on the sofa and simply take over the kitchen as if she owns it?
I've made you some nice hot tea, says Aurora, with a pitying, maddening demi-smile. I understand you've had a shock. You hit your head when you fainted, but they don't think you were concussed. You should have a CAT scan, though, just to be sure. I've arranged that for you later today.
Charmaine can't get out a word. She struggles to control her tears. She's heaving. She's gasping. Snot is running out of her nose.
Go ahead, have a good cry, says Aurora, as if granting royal permission. A good cry clears the air, not to mention the sinuses, she adds, her version of a joke.
Did you open my locker? Charmaine manages to squeeze out.
Now why would I do that? Says Aurora.
Someone did, says Charmaine. Because I'm wearing different clothes. The thought of Aurora changing her clothes like a Barbie doll's while she was out cold gives her a shuddery feeling all over.
I expect you did it yourself and just don't remember it. You must have had an episode of temporary amnesia, says Aurora in that know-it-all voice of hers. A shock like the one you've had can bring on a fugue state.
You were on the sofa when I got here 10 minutes ago.
She sets the tea tray down on the coffee table.
The brain is very protective. It decides what we choose to remember.
Charmaine feels anger flooding her, pushing out the grief. If she'd been down in the cellar getting stuff out of her locker, she'd remember it. In addition to which, she never would have picked this blouse. What kind of a fashion loser do they think she is? Who brought her back here from medications administration anyway?
She pulls herself upright, swings her legs down onto the floor. She absolutely, totally does not want Aurora to see her in this state, the state of a mud puddle. She wipes her nose and eyes on her sleeve since a tissue is lacking, brushes the damp hair back off her forehead, pulls her face into a semblance of order.
Thank you, she says, as crisply as she can.
Actually, I'm fine. Does Aurora know about what Charmaine has done to Stan? Maybe she can bluff, conceal her weakness. Say she fainted because she had her period or low blood sugar or something.
Well, that's very strong of you, says Aurora.
I mean, not many people would have such a firm sense of duty and loyalty.
She sits down on the sofa beside Charmaine.
I have to admire you. I really do.
She pours the tea into the cup, Charmaine's cup with the pink rosebuds that Stan never liked.
But he never liked tea anyway. He was a coffee kind of guy with cream and 2 sugars. She represses a sob.
I really should apologize on behalf of management, says Aurora, setting the cup down on the coffee table in front of Charmaine. It was so tactless of logistics.
She's put a cup for herself on the tray. She busies herself with filling it. Charmaine takes a gulp of tea.
It does help.
What do you mean? She says, though she knows perfectly well what Aurora means.
Aurora's enjoying this. She's relishing it.
They should have booked you for someone else's procedure, says Aurora.
They shouldn't have put you through such an ordeal.
She measures the sugar into her own cup, stirs it. What ordeal? Says Charmaine. I was just doing my job. But it's no use. She can see that in the tidy non-smile on Aurora's overlifted face.
He was your husband, wasn't he? Says Aurora. Your most recent procedure, according to the records.
Whatever the state of your private life together, and that is none of our business, and I don't want to pry, but whatever that state. Carrying out the procedure must have been, truly, a difficult decision for you to make.
She cranks up her smile, a smile of smarmy understanding. Charmaine feels like whacking her across the face. What do you know about it, you shriveled up prissy pants? She would like to yell.
I just do my job, she says defensively. I follow the prescribed routine, in all cases.
I appreciate your desire to, shall we say, blur the outlines, says Aurora. But we happen to have taped the entire process, as we do at random for quality control.
It was touching.
Watching you struggle with your emotions.
I was moved. I really was.
We all were.
We could see you faltering.
It was only natural. I mean, who wouldn't? You'd have to be inhuman.
But you did overcome them, those emotions.
Don't think we haven't noted that. The overcoming of the emotions. In fact, our chief himself, Ed, would like to thank you in person. And a little bird told me it's not official, but I think there might be a promotion in the offing. Because if anyone deserves it for the heroic.
I think you should leave now, says Charmaine, setting down her cup.
In one more minute, she is going to throw that cup and everything in it, smack dab in the middle of Aurora's prefab face.
Of course, says Aurora, with a half smile like a perfectly symmetrical slice of lemon.
I do feel your pain. It must be so, well, so painful.
The pain that you feel.
We've booked a trauma counselor for you because, of course, you will be experiencing survivor's guilt. Well, more than just survivor's guilt, because with a survivor, all they did was survive, whereas you, I mean...
Charmaine stands up abruptly, knocking over her cup. Please get out, she says as steadily as she can. Right now.
Go on, says her little inner voice. Bash this teapot over her head, cut her throat with a bread knife, then drag her downstairs and hide the body in your pink locker.
But Charmaine refrains. There would be telltale bloodstains on the rug. Plus, if they'd videotaped her with Stan and the needle, they might have a way of doing that inside this house as well.
You'll feel differently tomorrow, says Aurora, standing too. Still smiling her flat, stretched smile. We all adjust, in time. The funeral is on Thursday. That's in 2 days.
Electrical accident at the chicken facility is the explanation we're giving. It will be on the news tonight. Everyone at the funeral will want to offer condolences, so you should be prepared. I'll arrange a car for 6:30 to pick you up for your concussion CAT scan. It's after hours, but they'll be waiting for you specially. In your state, you shouldn't be driving your scooter.
I hate you, Charmaine yells. Evil witch!
But she waits until after the door has closed.
Coffee time.
Stan, says a voice. Time to move.
Stan opens his eyes. It's Jocelyn. She's shaking his arm. He stares at her groggily. About fucking time, he says. And thanks for leaving me in cold storage. Do you mind unshackling me? I need to take a leak. He has an image of how the next few minutes would go if this were a spy film. He'd deck Jocelyn, knock her out, find her keys,
snap her onto the bin, steal her phone so she couldn't call for help when she woke up. She must have a phone. And then go out and save the world all by himself.
Don't do anything spontaneous, says Jocelyn. I'm the only thing standing between you and rigor mortis, so pay very close attention. Because I can only go over this once. I'm due at a top-level meeting, so we have almost no time.
She's wearing her business getup, the trim suit, the little hoop earrings, the gray stockings. Strange to think of her prone underneath him or naked on top of him, where she has often been. Legs splayed, mouth open, hair wild as if blown by a squall. That seems like a different planet. She unlocks his tether, helps him to climb down out of the teddy bear bin. He's still wobbly. He staggers in behind the bin, takes a piss. He can't see any other place to do it, then staggers back out again. She has a small thermos of coffee with her. Thank fuck for that. He guzzles greedily, washing down the two painkiller pills that she hands him.
For the headache, she says. Sorry about it, but that drug's the only one we could use. Mimics the effects of the real thing, but without the finale.
How close did I get? Says Stan.
Nothing worse than a strong anesthetic, she says. Think of it as a holiday for your brain.
So, says Stan, I was wrong about Charmaine. She went for the bullseye.
She couldn't have been better, says Jocelyn, with an irritating smile. Acting wouldn't come close.
You callous asshole, he thinks. You know, you're a triple-grade shit, he says. Putting her through that? You've fucked up her head for life.
She's a little shaken, yes, says Jocelyn evenly. For the present. But we'll take care of her.
Stan doesn't find this too reassuring. Take care of her could mean something less than kind. Good, he says, nonetheless.
But I expect you're hungry, says Jocelyn.
Understatement, says Stan. Now that he thinks about it, he's ravenous. Out of her handbag, Jocelyn produces a cheese sandwich that he scarfs down in one bite. He could use a couple more of those, plus some chocolate cake and a beer. Where exactly the fuck am I? He says, once he's swallowed it all down.
In a warehouse, says Jocelyn.
Yeah, I got that. But am I still inside Positron Prison?
Yes, says Jocelyn. It's part of the facility.
So, are those coffins? He nods toward the oblong boxes. Jocelyn laughs.
No, they're shipping crates.
Stan decides not to ask what they might be shipping. Okay, so, he says. Where do I go? Unless you plan to keep me in here with these fucking bears.
I can understand your irritation, says Jocelyn. Bear with me, pardon the pun. She gives him a big-toothed grin. There are two things you have to remember for your own safety during your time here. First, your name is now Waldo.
Waldo, he says. Can't I be... Shit. In no way does he see himself as a Waldo. Wasn't that some kind of cartoon rabbit on kids' TV? Or a fish? No, that was Nemo. A cartoon thing, anyway. Where's Waldo?
It's a databank move, says Jocelyn. You're replacing a previous Waldo. He had an accident. Don't look at me like that. It was a real accident involving a soldering iron. You're inheriting his code, his identity. I've gone into the system and spliced in your biometrics.
Okay, he says. So I'm fucking Waldo.
What's the second thing? You'll be on a Possibilibots team, says Jocelyn. Just watch the others and follow orders.
Possibilibots? Says Stan. Is this something he's supposed to know? He can't place the term.
He's feeling dizzy again.
Any more coffee?
Possibilibots makes a Dutch-designed line of exact replica female sex aids, says Jocelyn. For home and export. I'm sure you'll find the work interesting.
You mean those prostabots? The sex robots? The guys at the scooter depot were talking about them.
That's the unofficial name for them, yes.
Once they're put together and tested for performance, they're packed into these boxes, she indicates the stacks of coffin-shaped containers, and shipped outside Consilience for deployment in amusement centers and other franchise areas. The Belgians are nuts about them, certain models, and some of the other models are very big in Southeast Asia. He thinks for a moment. And who will they think this Waldo is? The one I'm supposed to be. Won't they wonder where the other Waldo has gone?
They never knew that Waldo. They don't even know there was a Waldo. He was deployed elsewhere. But if they check the data bank, you'll be Waldo in there. Don't worry. Just keep saying your name is Waldo. And remember, the job here is the key to transferring you safely to the outside world.
When do we do that? Says Stan. And through some beam-me-up Scotty sleight of hand? An underground tunnel? Or what?
You'll be approached by someone here. The password is tiptoe through the tulips.
I can't tell you any more, in case you're suspected and questioned. In a perfect world, I'd be overseeing the questioning, but it's not a perfect world. Why would I be questioned? Says Stan.
He doesn't like any of this. Now that he's getting close to it, he no longer wants to be shipped to the outside world, because who knows what extreme crap is going on out there. It could be total anarchy by now. Given the choice, he'd elect to stay in Consilience with Charmaine. If only he could rewind to day one, wipe all that Jasmine crap, treat Charmaine the way she wanted to be treated, whatever that was, so she'd never go wandering off. The mere thought of her and of the house he once found so boring makes him feel weepy. But he can't rewind anything. He's stuck in the present. What are his options? He wonders what would happen if he snitched on Jocelyn. Her and her philandering scumbucket of a husband. But who would he snitch to? It would have to be someone in surveillance, and whoever it is would surely report directly to Jocelyn herself, and then he'd be dog food. He'll have to take his chances, go through with the Waldo charade, be Jocelyn's courier, in the name of freedom and democracy, no doubt. Not that he gives much of a flying fuck about freedom and democracy, since they haven't performed that well for him personally. You're unlikely to be questioned so long as you stick to the Waldo cover, says Jocelyn. But there are no unsinkable boats. I'm late for that meeting. Here's your Waldo name tag. All clear?
Sure, he says, though it's clear as rust paint.
Where do I go now?
Through that door, says Jocelyn.
Good luck, Stan. You're doing fine so far. I'm counting on you.
She pecks him on the cheek.
His impulse is to wrap his arms around her, clutch onto her like a lifeline. But he resists it.
Ajar. Charmaine has a little time before the car arrives to take her for the scan. Not that she thinks she needs the scan, but better to humor them. She wanders around the house. Her house. Putting things back in order. The tea towels, the pot holders. She hates it when the kitchen implements are left lying around like the corkscrew. That corkscrew has definitely been put to use by Max and his wife. They've always been slack on the tidying details. In the living room, there's a table lamp out of place. She'll fix that later. She doesn't feel like crawling around on the floor looking for the wall socket. And there's something in the DVD player of the flat-screen TV. Its little light is flashing. What has Max been watching? Not that she's still obsessed with him. Not after the shock she's had. Killing Stan has wiped Max from her mind. She pushes play. Oh. Oh, no. The blood rushes to her face. The screen swims. It's shadowy, it's out of focus, but it's her. Her and Max, in one of those empty houses,
racing toward each other, colliding, toppling to the floor. And those sounds coming out of her, like an animal in a trap. This is awful. She pushes eject, snatches up the silver disc. Who's been watching it? If it's only Max reliving their moments together, then she's kind of safe. What to do with it? Putting it in the trash would be fatal. Someone might find it. And if she breaks it into pieces, all the more reason for them to reconstruct it. She takes it into the kitchen, slides it in between the refrigerator and the wall. There. Not a terrific hidey hole, but she's improvised hidey holes in the past. And that worked out okay, so it's better than nothing. Act normal, Charmaine, she tells herself. Supposing you can remember what normal is. She's unsteady on her feet, but she makes it to the powder room off the front hall where she splashes water on her face, then wipes it off and leans in closer to the mirror. Her hair is a bird's nest. Her eyes are puffy. Maybe some cold tea bags? And she can spray product on her hair, which will keep it in place for the short term. Stan didn't like the scent of the hair product. He said it made her smell like paint remover. She's nostalgic, even for his annoying put-downs. Don't cry anymore, she tells herself. Just do one thing at a time. Get from hour to hour and day to day like a frog jumping on lily pads. Not that she has ever seen a frog doing that, except on TV. Her makeup and stuff is in the bedroom. She stands at the bottom of the stairs looking up. It seems like a long climb. Maybe down to the cellar first. Check out her locker. Get out of this stupid floral print blouse. Find the right one, the peach with the ruffles. It's easier to go downstairs than up. As long as you don't fall down them, Charmaine, she warns herself. Her knees are weak. Hold on to the railing. That's the girl, as Grandma Wynne would say. Put one foot on the first stair, then the other one beside it, like when you were three. You need to take care of yourself, because who else will? There. Standing on the solid cellar floor, swaying swaying. Now she's standing beside the four lockers, which are side by side. They're horizontal, with lids that lift up like freezer chests. Her locker, pink. Stan's, green. Then the lockers of the alternates, which are purple and red. The red one is Max's, and the purple one belongs to that wife of his, whom Charmaine hates on principle. If she could wave a magic wand and make both of those lockers disappear, she would, because then she could make that whole chunk of the past disappear as well. None of it would ever have happened, and Stan would still be alive. She leans over to punch in the code for her locker. The lid is open a little, from whoever has been rummaging in her things. Here's the peach blouse. She takes off her suit jacket and the blue print blouse and struggles into the peach one. Struggles because one of her shoulders is sore. She must have hit it when she passed out. Doing up the buttons is hard because of her shaky fingers, but she manages it. She puts the suit jacket back on. Now she feels less discordant. And here are all her civilian clothes, including the ones she had on the last time she checked in at Positron, the cherry-colored pullover, the white bra. Someone must have brought them back here and put them away. They must know her code. Well, of course they know her code, because they know everyone's code. She used to hide things in this locker. She used to think they were truly hidden. How ditzy that had been. She'd bought that cheap fuchsia lipstick that smelled like bubblegum so she could put kisses on her notes for Max. I'm starved for you. Silly things like that. She should get rid of it. Bury it in the backyard. She'd wrapped that lipstick in a handkerchief and tucked it into the toe of one of her shoes with the high heels right here. But it's gone. It isn't there. She feels around with her hands.
She needs to bring a flashlight. It's most likely rolled out somehow when whoever it was pawed through her stuff.
She'll find it later, and when she does, she'll throw it far, far away. It's a memento. And memento means something that helps you remember.
She'd rather have a forgetto.
It's a joke. She has made a joke. You are a shallow, frivolous person, says the little voice. Can't you keep it in your stupid head that Stan is...
Not another word, she tells it. She shuts the top of her locker, codes it closed.
As she turns to leave, she sees that Stan's green locker is ajar. Someone's been in there, too.
She knows she shouldn't look in. It will be bad for her to see Stan's familiar clothes all neatly folded, the summer t-shirts, the fleece jacket he used to wear when he pruned the hedge. She'll start thinking about how those clothes are empty of Stan forever, and she'll start crying again, and then it will be the puffy eyes, only twice as puffy.
Better to erase it all. She'll call the consilience removal service tomorrow and have them come in and take away Stan's clothes. She can start anew, in a whole different place. They'll put her in one of the condos for singles. Maybe there's a special building for widows. Even though she'll be a lot younger than the average widow, she can do those widow things with the other widows. Play cards, look out the window, watch the leaves change color. It will be peaceful, at any rate, being a widow. So she should not upset herself by messing around with Stan's coffin, with Stan's locker. But she walks over anyway and lifts the lid. The locker's empty. Erase me. She's sitting on the cellar floor. How long has she been doing that? And why was it such a shock, finding Stan's locker empty?
She should have expected it. Naturally, they would come and clear away his things.
To save her the distress. They're very thoughtful, the consilience team.
Maybe it was that gloating meanie Aurora, she thinks. Can't keep her nosy nose out of it, rolling around in my sadness like a dog in poo.
The doorbell rings.
She could just sit here until they go away. She's not up to getting her head CAT scanned. Not right now.
But the bell rings again, and then she can hear the door opening.
They have the door code, of course they do.
She pulls herself upright, makes it to the cellar stairs, and climbs. There's a woman in the living room. She's bending over, doing something to the TV, even though it's off. Dark hair, a suit. Hello, says Charmaine. Sorry I was late answering the door. I was just down in the cellar.
The woman straightens up, turns. She smiles. I'm here to take you to your CAT scan appointment, she says.
The small hoop earrings, the bangs, the square teeth. It's the head from the reception box at Medications Administration. Charmaine gasps. Oh, my gosh, she says.
She sits down on the sofa like a stone falling.
You're the head.
Excuse me, says the woman.
You're the talking head at reception in the box. You told me to kill Stan, says Charmaine. And now he's dead.
She should not be saying these words, but she can't help it. You've had a shock, says the woman in a compassionate voice that does not fool Charmaine for one second. They pretend to be sympathetic. They pretend they're helping. But they have other ideas in mind.
You said it was a test, says Charmaine. You said I had to follow the procedure to show I was loyal. So I darn well followed it because I am darn loyal. And now Stan's dead because of you.
She can't stop the tears. Here they come again, out of her puffy eyes, but she doesn't care. You're confused, says the woman calmly. It's normal to blame others.
The mind in shock reverts to the habits of childhood and provides agency. We find it hard to grasp the randomness of the universe.
That is total garbage, and you know it, says Charmaine. It was you. You were in that reception box. What I want to know is why. Why did you want to kill my Stan? He was a good man. What did he ever do to you?
It's important for you to see a doctor, says the woman. They'll check for concussion, then give you a sedative to help you sleep. I'm so sorry about your husband and the terrible accident at the Positron Prison Chicken Facility. The fire was caused by faulty wiring. But because of your husband's swift action, most of the chickens were saved, as well as a number of his co-workers. He was heroic. You should be proud of him.
I have never heard such a bag of pure twaddle in my entire life, thinks Charmaine. But what should I do? Play along? Pretend to believe her? If I don't, if I keep on telling the truth and pushing her to tell it as well, she'll say I'm unstable, disruptive, hallucinating off the charts. Call in the surveillance heavies, haul me off to a cell, shackle me to a bed like Sandy, then stick a drug into me, and then, if I don't so-called improve, it might get terminal. She takes a breath. Breathe out, breathe in. What they want is compliance, the opposite of disruptive. Oh, I am proud of Stan, she says. Gosh, does her voice ever sound so phony? I am so proud of him. I really am. I'm not surprised he sacrificed himself to save other people and the chickens, too. He was always such an unselfish man. And an animal lover, she adds for good measure. The woman smiles her deceptive smile. Underneath that business suit, she's muscular, thinks Charmaine. She could tackle me, have me down in an instant. I wouldn't win a scuffle with her. And she's not wearing a name tag. How do I know she is who she says she is?
I'm glad you agree, says the woman. Keep that story firmly in mind. Consilience management will do whatever is required to help you with the grieving process. Is there anything you feel you need right now? We could send someone over to stay with you tonight, for instance. Provide some company, make you a cup of tea. Aurora from Human Resources is kindly offered.
Thank you, says Charmaine demurely. That's very kind of her, but I feel sure I can manage.
We'll see, says the woman. Now, it's time for us to get you to that CAT scan appointment. They're waiting for you. The car's outside. Do you have a coat?
I think it's in my locker, says Charmaine.
But when the woman opens the hall closet,
there it is, her coat, hanging on a hanger, ready for her. It's like a stage prop.
A pale pink smear lingers in the west, from where the sun has set. There's a light dusting of snow. The woman takes Charmaine's arm as they go down the walk. There's a dark silhouette in the front of the car. The driver. We'll sit in the back, says the woman.
She opens the door, stands aside for Charmaine. They certainly do treat you like royalty when they decide to take care of you, thinks Charmaine. Now the inside car light is on. As she gets into the car, Charmaine sees the driver's profile. She gives a small scream.
Max, she says. Her heart opens like a hot rose. Oh, save me.
The driver turns his head, looks at her. It's Max, all right. How could she ever forget him? His eyes, his dark hair, that mouth. Soft but hard, urgent, demanding.
Pardon me? Says the man.
His face is immobile.
Max, I know it's you, she says. How dare he pretend not to recognize her?
You're mistaken, says the driver. I'm Phil. I drive for surveillance.
Max, what in heck is going on? Why are you lying?
Charmaine almost shouts. The man has unpinned his name tag.
Look, he says, handing it to her. Phil. That's what it says here. My name tag. That's me.
Is there a problem? Says the woman, who's now sliding into the back seat beside Charmaine.
She says my name is Max.